Lace up your boots and grab your mouthguards. It's time for the Rugby Wrap, the podcast about all things Western Force and the game we love.
Well, hello and welcome to the Rugby Wrap. Nice to have your company wherever you may be tuning in. My name's Mick Collis and it's always great to be joined by this man, Wallaby number 735, Mitch Hardy. Mitch, good to see you.
Nice to be back again, Mickey. And those not lucky enough to see you tonight, mate, you're looking very splendid in your short sleeve puffy jacket. Everyone is missing out on that one. You're looking absolute treat tonight, Mickey.
I've just got off the water and I'm a bit cold.
Yeah, mate, I'm all over it. I'm on the Matilda's bandwagon. It's World Cup fever and the Rugby World Cup's just around the corner. It's all been happening up here in Darwin, mate. So
yeah, well, we'll touch on that. We'll touch on the Darwin experience in the mailbag. And one of the true stars from the Netherlands club, Heath Tessman. Tess, good to see you.
like I said, looking resplendent. I'll echo Mitchy. You're looking resplendent tonight in that puffy vest with no shirt on underneath. So just a hint of pec sitting out the side. It's beautiful.
Yeah, excellent. Now, with the appointment of new Wallabies coach Andy Jones and the announcement of the World Cup squad, rugby's been getting plenty of attention of late. Now, while there's lots of positive, there's also lots of questions still being asked. So one man to help us sort it all out is current Rugby Australia board member and Wallaby number 715, Daniel Herbert. And Daniel, great to have you with us on the Rugby Wrap.
Good evening, gents. Pleasure to be with you.
Now, mate, obviously the big news was the naming of the Wallaby squad for France. What did you think?
Oh, look, I'm pretty excited by the squad. I think there's a fair bit for today and I think there's a fair bit there for tomorrow. And, I think there's... You know, there's a few questions that you always have around selection and, I think you just, well, certainly my view is, we've hired a really good coach in Eddie. You've got to back his view that, he's going to get the best out of them. He didn't feel he was going to get there with, some of the group that he had. So he's taken a punt and knockout tournaments, you can get there through, build up of over a long period of time. And I think out of the nine World Cups that we've had, the eventual winners probably been in the top two teams leading into the tournament, and then there's been probably a couple where they've come from nowhere, and often that's South Africa. But Australia made the final two World Cups ago against the run of play, and there's been plenty of teams that have done that. So I think there's enough within the team to be excited about, but also I think there's enough there for the future to get excited about as well.
And Will Skelton as captain.
Yeah, look, I mean, I was surprised. It wasn't something that I expected, but it was something we'd had some conversations about where Eddie felt that Will offered something that not many other people offered, and in terms of he's got a great rapport with the group, a lot of respect. He's not a big talker, and I think we associate a lot of captaincy leadership with people who talk a lot and lead from the front and are comfortable in front of cameras, and he's not necessarily cut from that. But this is a campaign. I don't look at it, and Eddie labelled it the smash and grab, or call it the hit and run, whatever you want. It's not a it's not a well crafted 4-year lead in. It's we're going in a knockout tournament, and we're going to throw some big haymakers, and he's picked a guy who's been really successful and respected in France and in the UK. Had a lot more success than I guess most of us have ever enjoyed. So, I think it could end up being a really inspired appointment. I'm just looking at it as it's for this campaign, what he feels is best for this campaign, and we'll see after that.
And just with the process of the selection of that team, so does he, is Eddie sort of pick his team, and then does he have to present that to the board? And so how's that all work?
Well, it gets approved, but you're not going to go too far against, you don't hire really good people and then stare over their shoulder and tell them what to do. So,
yep.
Eddie and his assistant coaches pick the team. It gets ratified. The captaincy is probably something a little bit more that we take an interest in, because we think there's a wider remit of that role than just running onto a field and captaining that group through a tournament and in the lead-in, et cetera. There's a wider remit of that, but... as I said before, this is viewed as a campaign, and it was certainly something that was approved and ratified. But it's probably something we take more interest in than the selection of the team. I don't think, unless you're prepared to sit down and spend the time watching hours and hours of games both here and abroad, I don't think you're in the right to be a selector. And, you know, certainly, you know, I'm not, and Phil's not, and none of the other board members are selectors, because we haven't got the right, because we're not going to sit there and trawl through the sort of games that coaches need to these days. There's a lot of analysis goes into it, and, you know, the guys here on the court would know that Eddie's a real student of the game, and so we trust that what he's done, he's put a lot of thought into it.
Now, it's a pretty young squad, so he's picked a squad for the future. Is the result at the 2027 World Cup more important than the result at the 2023 World Cup?
Well, if you ask me, because it's at home, and if you look at the Matildas World Cup, I mean, if the Matildas World Cup was played overseas at the moment, would it have the same impact on the Australian market? You know, I think the answer is no. And if the Matildas don't make it through the pool stages, then does it have a big impact? Obviously not. So, look, for me, it does, but I think that would that's not to say that, you know, 23 is, you know, we've laid up in 23 to go to 27. He is an animal. He's a World Cup animal. He wants to, in terms of Eddie, he wants to win everything he goes into. And, you know, he's, in terms of World Cups, his you know, one of the big things around his appointment was he got two cracks at that cherry. So he's certainly not laying up thinking, I don't have a team here that could possibly do it. He's obviously very short on time with the run-in to do that. But, you know, he's still going to go hell for leather and try and do as best he can.
So now the Rugby World Cup, that comes around every 4 years. But in the years between those World Cups, we've got Super Rugby, Bledisloe Cup contests and so on. Now, there was an interesting article by Jamie Panduram in The Australian a week or so ago titled Australian Rugby Overhaul Needed to End Bledisloe Cup Humiliation. And it quotes Sakopi Kepu saying that coaches and administrators must put their egos aside and be transparent or step down if Australia is ever to wrest back the Bledisloe Cup. And then there had similar themes to an article that Christy Doran wrote back in 2018, which quoted you as saying that Rugby Australia must move to a centralised system and support their coaches. So what would you, that's 5 years ago and still nothing's happened. What would you like to see done differently in Australian rugby around that sort of centralisation system?
Well, Mitch touched on the Matildas at the start of the podcast here in terms of what impact that's having across the country. You know, rugby, similar to soccer, it's a global game. There's a massive opportunity, a massive global opportunity that you get by playing in that World Cup. But there's also all of the football that's played in between those World Cups. And I think Australia, if I go back, you know, and I'll probably have to go back a little way to think about where Australia was comparatively, where it is now comparatively, and you know, we used to be a very, very smart, not just team, but a very smart game. I think we punched well above our weight for many, many years. But I think, you know, in terms of the, I saw the article you're talking about with Sakopi Kepu, and, you know, a lot of people, most people within rugby and rugby admin and people who've been in and around rugby admin for a long time know that model. They understand what happened in New Zealand. Less people probably know what happened in Ireland. Probably around 2013, in terms of where Ireland were and where they've got to. And, you know, I think it's the biggest thing for me that could happen in the game, because as we touched on what happened with the Matildas, if that shop front window is performing, if that team is performing, that the whole of the country can get behind, then it just inspires the kids to play the game. And it means the sponsorship money's going to come in. It means people are going to turn up to watch. But we do have, and have had for a long time, a slightly fragmented model. And, you know, that, you know, as I touched on, I think that's probably the most important thing we can do is actually put the players at the centre and make sure that we, and I think we have an obligation to the players and the fans to make sure that we're maximising what we can. And at the moment, we're not. Countries like Ireland and New Zealand have. And they've got similar competition. They've got similar challenges that we have. But they worked out, we're still working to an old model that we started with in 1996 when the game went professional. And what's happened is other countries have gotten very organised and gone beyond us. And whether we've gone backwards or they've just gone ahead or a bit of both, we're now in a position where we've got really good athletes. I mean, that was something Eddie's touched on. We've got good football players. There's the athletic makeup there to have a really good team. But we need to make sure that we're maximising what we do and how we manage those players, how we manage their development, how we manage the coaching, how we manage all of the aspects that go into a high-performance environment And we manage that as one system, not six fragmented systems, but one united system. And as soon as we can get that, and high performance and the guys on the pool know, it's about small margins. And at the moment, we've got small margins leaking out of the system because we've got, you know, simple things like strength and conditioning. They're not necessarily aligned. You know, what you do at a state level is not necessarily what you do at a national level, and they might not talk to one another. They might not share data, how you manage injuries, the coach development, how you identify talent within the system. So there's all these things that, you know, whether it's you call it a centralized model or an aligned model, everyone knows who's been in around the game. Everyone knows what has to happen. People just may disagree on how to get there, or you know, you end up in some sort of horse trade where people are saying we need this to commit to that. And you know, I think Sakopi's right, and you know, others that have been in and around and have seen and experienced those sorts of systems. The system is what actually makes people better. And you know, Mitch is on the call. Mitch went into a really good high performance system in the Brumbies, and it worked really well. Now, what other countries have started to do in terms of New Zealand, they were really brave with what they did. They got knocked out of a 2007 final or quarterfinal in the World Cup. They then all got together and they got on the same hymn sheet. And, you know, since then, they've performed extremely well. Ireland, similarly, in I think it was around 2012, 2013. The guy who's running their system tried to bring this system into Australia. And, you know, he was run out of town for trying to do so, and he's done it now in Ireland, and we've seen the results of that. So, look, if we can do that, then we can be world beaters. But it's going to take a group of people to just get a line behind what that actually means. And it needs to put the fans and the players at the forefront.
Because what's stopping it? I mean, it seems to make a lot of sense, but so what's stopping it? Is it individual egos or the individual franchises not wanting to?
No, it's not. I wouldn't call it individual egos or anything like that. It's we have a government system. I mean, sport reflects the way that government's set up, where the Prime Minister can come out and say we want to do this, but then at a state level, the Premier can say no, we're going to do this. Because everyone's fighting for, and it's no one's fault. It's no one's fault because collectively over a period of time, we just haven't been able to get on the same page. And that's not saying, you know, I worked at a member union, at a state union for 8 years. You know, and you can see things a certain way, and then you can see them through a different lens when you're outside of that. But, you know, we've been warned about this in various reports that have been written about the game since the early 2000s, that if we don't maximise this opportunity, that it'll lead to a gradual decay of the game and a deterioration of fans and the performance on the field. And the performance on the field is really important with what happens off the field in terms of people being inspired to play and support the game, because they don't want their team to lose. We're not like the AFL and NRL, where 50% of the teams win every week. We play against New Zealand, who's historically the most successful team or union in the world, and we have to play them all the time. And it's not like England, who might get to play them once every 3 years or 5 years. We have to play them all the time in Super Rugby and at national level. So, so we've got to be on our game. And at the moment, there's all this leakage, and I'm not going to sit here and say it's anyone's fault. It's no one's fault. It's just collectively we need to just say, you know what, there are no more chances, because the model right now is broken. We need to get on that same page and just take a leap of faith. And actually what matters is the fan watching, who wants their teams to win, and what matters is the player, who wants to make sure they're in a really good environment and maximise their opportunity. But one of the funny things, Mick, that you know, from even talking to people within these great models that you observe from outside, is sometimes you talk to people within those systems and they don't realise themselves that the system is what's making them successful. They often think that it's because they've got better players or they've got better coaches. Well, it's only because they've got a system that's developing that and has developed that over a long period of time, and they're bearing the fruits of that. There's a reason why Ireland have gone from whatever they were, eighth in the world, to number one in the world now. And it's not through having better athletes or better rugby players than us, because we've actually got, and this is, you know, this was something that was said to me by the guy running the system, you've actually got far better athletes than what we have. But we've actually managed to coordinate them in one direction and get the most out of them. And, you know, Australia has to do that. I fear we just don't have too many more opportunities. He tried to do this back in, I think, 2010, 2012, and many administrations have tried to coordinate this, and it's just very hard, because what it's saying is you've got to give up a few of the levers of control that you're used to having, and people get a bit worried about that. So, look, it's a really big thing. As far as I'm concerned, it's the most important thing we can do, and if we don't do it, then we've got this opportunity of the men's game, the women's game, coming up with the World Cups that we've got. We've got the Lions coming in 2 years' time. Huge opportunity. You have a look at the Matildas right now. That could be the Wallabies and Wallaroos in 4, 5, 6 years' time, where we are front and centre for the world in front of our home crowd. And if we're performing well and we're going to make it through to the final, we'll put this game again on the map and we'll maximise the opportunity. If we don't, then we're going to miss the boat. And it's not going to be a flick of the switch either. It's going to take a little while for the benefits to that system to come through.
And Mitch, you're nodding your head.
Yep. I like what Herbie's talking about there. I mean, I think there's a lot of merit in a centralised system. You know, we've spoken about it before. You know, things like the benefits of having a draft and centralised talent system, and sharing that talent amongst a network of teams has got a lot of merit, and that's the way the Institute network works kind of in Australia as well, with all the Olympic sports. Is you know athletes who might have come out of the Northern Territory can go and be part of the hockey program in Western Australia, because that's what's best for the hockey program for Australia. You know what I mean? So you could put a lens on it where the franchises and Australian rugby, as far as the Wallabies and the Wallaroos are concerned, you could have a centralised system where they still can keep their integrity of their name and their base and that sort of stuff, but it's all part of one integrated system. And I think there's a lot of merit in that, especially for the talent pathway side of things, and about exposing the talent at the right time, not warehousing talent. But then you've got to flip it on its head and ensure that if you go to that centralised system, the primary role of the states and territories then is about fostering a club system and a premier rugby system that feeds into that. And that's where that they could concentrate their efforts to ensure that it's underpinned. And I think there's a lot of merit in exploring that further, because we all recognise that Australia is unique in that we've got this premier grassroots rugby system that feeds into our elite system, and there's a bit of a void between the two. So, yep, at the elite level, that would probably improve the Wallabies and Wallaroos' performance, but then we need to ensure that we've got an underpinning system that supports that, and that's where we need to probably concentrate our efforts. And I think we just haven't... I still believe we nearly got it right with NRC, and then we threw it out for whatever reasons. And there was pros and cons to it, but I still think there's a lot of merit in building underpinning programs that support your structure. And if that's a centralised franchise system, then yeah, I'm right on board with that, because if you're all heading in the same direction, if you've all got economies of scale around coach appointments, S&C programs, medical support, and you're sharing all that IP and systems amongst a whole of Australia and the whole of the Australian system, there's only an upside to that. In my view, you'll say from a business operation side, it makes sense. Economies of scale, investment, all that sort of stuff. We won't waste money anymore. We'll make informed decisions based on what the system is needed. And you know, David Nussafora, let's call him out. He's done a wonderful job over there in Ireland about, you know, fostering that system in Ireland and making it work with a very limited talent base. Let's face it.
Success breeds success as well. So. By having that, I guess, that singular focus, what's happened in, you know, both Ireland and New Zealand, it hasn't actually been to the detriment of other people or other, you know, the franchises or provinces or whatever you want to call them. It hasn't been to the detriment. Leinster would be regarded with the Crusaders as probably the premier provincial team in the world. So that success filters through the system because everything improves. The tide is lifted. And Mitch is right. You've got to underpin that though with something else. There has to be a better system bringing players and bringing coaches. It's not just coaches. It's, you know, it's all of that high-performance system. There has to be the, I guess, the identification and the development of those guys and girls as well. So there's a fair bit to it, but it's not, I feel it's not complicated because it's actually been done. If we went to do it, you know, back when it was introduced around 2010, 2011, we would have not quite been the pioneers, but would have been at the front end of it. And we were still close enough to the heyday that we didn't feel we needed it. You know, I think we felt, and to a certain point, sometimes we still feel that, oh, if we just change the coach, that'll fix everything. And it's, you know, as good as Eddie is and as good as any coach can be, it's not going to fix a broken system. And, you know, I think we have an obligation to the people that play and support the game to put the system around that that can maximise, you know, the enjoyment, the participation, but also the support of their game. They want, you know, Australians love a winner. If the, as I said, if the Matildas got knocked out on the pool stages, is anyone tuning in like they are right now? The answer is no. So we've got a big opportunity, but we can't afford for bits and pieces to leak out of the system through this, I guess, lack of alignment.
And I don't want to sound critical, but we've said it a few times on this podcast, Mick, is we've got to make decisions based on what's best for Australian rugby, not what's best for the Australian rugby team. So the performance of the Australian rugby team is just a product of the system. So we've got to start making decisions what's best for Australian rugby. And if that means changing the system, then that's what they should be doing. Because the performance of the Australian rugby team is an output of that. We'll see it. But at the moment, it seems to be every time we kind of make, and you know, don't take this the wrong way, Herbie, because I know you're on the board, but every time we make a decision, it seems to be the tail wagging the dog. It's about, oh, let's make the decision based on the 33 blokes that are out there at the moment, not the actual bigger picture where it's about the Australian rugby system.
Because Herbie, I heard from some players in Queensland that the Wallaby coach, it was Dave Rennie, turned up to a Queensland Reds training session and was basically told to leave. So are you saying with the other in Ireland and wherever it might be where they've got this centralised system that the teams like not share information, but is there more of a sharing of information for the benefit of New Zealand rugby?
Well, I mean, in terms of the – I mean – They're both slightly different. In terms of New Zealand and Ireland, they're both slightly different. And South Africa, you've got a different system altogether. And I think it's working out what's the best system that's going to suit Australia. And it might be slightly different, but effectively it's putting the athlete or the rugby player at the centre. And it's saying, we need, you know, you have a 5 to 10 year lifespan and we've got to get the most out of that, the player, and we've got to get the most out of the system. And at the moment, sometimes I feel that there's, you know, there's a bit of push and pull. And, you know, it's you know, if we had anyone who might be listening works for a multinational company, you don't have, if you've got a, you know, if you've got an office in every state, they don't all work on a different IT system. They don't all work to different processes and, you know, work instructions. It's all centralized around, will we all perform better if we actually align to the one system? And it's really, that's what we're talking about, is actually saying, well, you know, this player or this coach, we need to make sure that we're identifying the talent at the right end. We need to make sure that we're developing that talent. But at the moment, the system is not so that, or it's not so aligned that you're going to invest in it wholly because you don't have control over that system to actually invest in it. So to invest in it, you actually need to make sure that people are aligned to it. And, you know, if you've got a 100-metre runner who's going to the Olympics, you're not going to give him two different programs for 6 months of the year. But at the moment, what's happening, and this has been every Wallaby coach since they started, so this is not any different, but they get five groups of players who come in different condition. You know, they're all in different physical shape. You've got players who come in and they're broken from playing when they shouldn't be playing because you've got coaches and people worried about, well, if, you know, my job's on the line, so I've got to play this player whether they're broken or not, or whether they're fit or not. So there's no sort of centralised system around management. Yes, there's sharing of data and, you know, there's I guess, some of that information that is shared, but it's not working on one system, working to making sure that we're all collectively getting the best out of these players and developing these players and coaches. Because it's, and there's more to go in than just the players, but if you focus on we need the players to perform at the best level, what goes into ensuring that, there's a number of different pieces, but at the moment, everyone's doing their bit and everyone's working really hard. It's not to, you know, not to discredit anyone. Everyone's working as hard as they can, but we're actually, you know, to use an old analogy, we're not all, you know, rowing in the right direction. You know, we're sort of slightly off kilter, and elite sport is fine margins. And at the moment, that's what's seeping out. And we're working to a system that, that we, you know, when rugby went professional overnight, all of the countries around the world, I mean, it's a great sort of case study around how everyone, every nation dealt with going professional overnight. England and France had a different model based around the clubs, and then Australia, New Zealand, South Africa all operated slightly differently. And what's happened is over a period of time, some others have got aligned and got really smart around how they do or how they get the best out of this system, and others have just persevered with old systems, and that's, unfortunately, that's Australia.
So back in the day when I was working in rugby, Mickey, there was a concept that we'd all become Australian rugby employees at some point in time, and when we're walking around with our rugby WA shirts or our New South Wales rugby shirts, we'd have the state on one side and Australian rugby on the other. And that was all about that sort of one unitary model approach about we're all part of the same system, the same company, if you like, that we're all part of Australian rugby. And it sort of fell on its head because people just got protective of their patch. And it became, you know, Rugby WA and Western Force rather than Rugby WA and Australian rugby. And I think that in itself, if people can wrap their heads around that, and we get these boards and directors and administrators to wrap their heads around that and understand that if they can all work as one system, we're going to be a lot better off for it. Because Eddie's objective is win the World Cup, number one, and then fall in love with the Australian rugby team, number two. So we need to work out how we do both of those things.
Yeah, and diversity of tactics and diversity of playing style, that's all great. I mean, it's a good thing to have teams who are doing different things, but diversity of skill level, diversity of fitness level, diversity of sort of talent ID across different states. I mean, that's not helpful, you know, and that's not a true high performance system or network. And that's what we've got to get to. If we're going to be serious and we think we're going to, you know, get the most, and we've got enough competition on our hands with AFL and NRL and all the other sports that we compete with. We don't need to be competing with ourselves. And until we can sort of realise that and wake up to it, that if we can, even with that competition, and don't forget Ireland has Gaelic and hurling, they're not quite the NRL or AFL, but they've got competition for athletes. But they've managed to, you know, and in Ireland it was the 32 amateur clubs. So it actually wasn't the provinces. The 32 amateur clubs that got together and signed a white paper that gave to David Noose for and said, you have control to run the best system because we need our national team performing on the world stage, because that has so much impact on all of our teams and our game that we can't afford for it not to compete and win. And so that's, for me, that's just a great example. You know, all of these teams still have their independence. They still manage to, manage to turn out very good teams. And, you know, they've got good fan bases. They've got good commercial. I mean, Irish rugby is now quite a commercial powerhouse based on the fact that they've been performing well. So it just everything drives, you know, performance drives the economics of it. And at the moment, we can focus on the economics, but in elite sport, the economics aren't going to work unless you're performing on the field. And we haven't been for 20 years.
Mitch mentioned, and we'll let you go shortly, but Mitch mentioned the NRC. There was an article by Paul Cully, I think it was during the week, he interviewed Tony Lewis, the Western Force boss who ran Tasman, and he was talking about that the price tag of a third-tier competition is manageable, certainly less than the cost of doing nothing. A third-tier competition can build the network of coaches, analysts and support staff needed to rebuild Australian rugby, and that Super Rugby clubs are already spending money on overseas tours to fill the months-long gap between Super Rugby seasons. What are your thoughts and Rugby Australia's thoughts on this third-tier? Phil Ward's come out and said he thinks it should be that club-based thing. Is that set in stone? Is there any life in something like an NRC competition in the future?
Well, I'd say with the NRC, and prior to that it was the ARC, there's been two cracks at it, and it for whatever reason, it hasn't worked. I mean, I was at Queensland Rugby when we had the NRC there for a couple of years, and we decided to back it 100%. We had two teams, and we just wanted to win, and we saw it as a really good opportunity. It was a bit of a commercial drain, and the problem was trying to get the fan base to support these teams that people saw as manufactured. If you could afford to say, well, we're going to sink a bunch of money into this, but we expect no return from it from a commercial base, but it's purely a high performance, part of the high performance system, we're not in that position right now to invest the sort of money that goes along with that. And the teams we had, Brisbane City and Queensland Country up here, we felt that, there'd be strong support and they would gradually get their own. And we had a couple of really big crowds for some of the finals. Look, it was hard. And previously before that, the ARC, so you look at that and go, well, at the moment where we are, can we actually do that? I think it'd be great if we could. But the reality is right now we've got a lot of the stakeholders who are financially struggling, including Rugby Australia, who hasn't, since COVID has been, and even before COVID, has had to borrow money to keep the lights on. So, it's not something that we can afford to put a lot of money into or a lot of investment into. And I'd take the point that you could take the view that, well, you can't afford not to. But it's a, I note Mitch's comments that I think we almost got it right. There, it certainly plays a part in terms of, some of the coaches that then and players that got opportunities from that to go on and represent. I take that on, or, take all of that on board and was close to it at the time. But it's, in all reality, it's not something that we can invest in at this point in time.
Fair enough. Tess or Mitch, you got anything else before we let him go?
No, I won't get on my high horse, mate. It's all good. Herbie's been very generous with his time and he's put some good points forward. So, I think the good thing about this conversation this evening is that there's got to be that dialogue that starts to be thought through as far as, okay, this is great, we're coming into the World Cup now, but we've got a four-year pathway now between 2023 and 2027. What are the subtle changes that we can make in the system that's going to set us up for 2027? How do we get the average punter on the street to fall in love with Australian rugby again?
Yeah.
That's what we've got to work towards. And I think everyone's got a role to play from the clubs all the way through. But, from Herbie's points today around the high performance system, there's a lot of improvements that can be made. It's just going to take some courage and a couple of big calls to make it. And again, I don't want to criticise, but I'd much sooner see money invested into the high performance system than an individual. So when we're talking about targeting individual players, if that money was redirected into a high performance system to improve the system, big fan.
Yeah. All right, Daniel, mate, we appreciate your time this afternoon. Enjoy the Matildas and enjoy the World Cup, which is not that far away.
Thanks, Jen. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks, Herbie. Take care.
So that was Daniel Herbert, Rugby Australia board member. And Tess, he makes a lot of sense in what he says.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And it's the analogy of we've just all got to be rowing the boat in the same direction. And I think we talked about like the New Zealand system and how they, they had coaches dropping in and helping out with different teams. And there's definitely been that's been attempted in the past. Like that was what Michael Checker tried to bring in during his year as well, though probably not in as strong a centralization kind of theme. And I think perhaps he was maybe the wrong person to try and lead it and sell it. But during that period, that was definitely what he was trying to get, that alignment. But I think he was trying to, physically rip it away, where it really needs to be, that little bit of power needs to be given up by the state unions and know that they're going to get something better from it as a result. Because, that was the period where Mick Byrne was going around to all the teams trying to improve the skill levels. There was strength conditioning levels that were expected for everyone to be, if they wanted to be able to play for the Wallabies. So that there were the bars, there were the little wheels in place. But I think as well, like part of it was that we were just taking what New Zealand had done and trying to just fit it into our mold here. And you know, like we touched on, Herbie touched on there in his talk, like there's no perfect, no other country's perfect solution is going to be perfect for us. So that matched up with the state unions giving up that bit of power and just knowing that they're going to have, there's going to be some of those teething problems early on, but that the if we stay the course, we're all going to get to where we want to be as a rugby playing nation, that, you know, the result will be worthwhile.
It's interesting that where he said that the coaches, like if they're playing a busted player, because the coaches think, well, my job's on the line, so bugger the national side, I'm worrying about my own little patch of my own career. If that guy's busted, I need him to play. So I think it's a great idea, but I don't know whether these coaches have got to almost be given a guarantee that they're not going to be sacked, you know, if before their contracts run out, if something happens. So there's a lot of...
If they're all part of the same system, it's not a matter. So if they're all treated equal, and they've all got equal decision making, and they're all being equally led, then it's, you know, there's no right or wrong decision there.
Well, and what is, like, I don't know, Mitchie, do you know, like, as far as coaching turnover in the Ireland teams, as far as Munster, Leinster, all those teams, like, they don't really have a very high turnover of coaches, do they?
System. No, very stable system. When you look at a guy like Les Kiss, who left Australian rugby some eons ago and has returned to the fold now. But, like, he was entrenched in that system for a long period of time.
Andy Friend as well.
David Nisifora has been there for an extended period of time. Before Scotty Wisemantle came back to Australian rugby, he was in the UK for a long extended period of time. Eddie over there for a long extended period of time. So there's long-term tenure for coaches in the UK and in Europe as well. So whereas Australia rugby seems to churn them in and spit them out real quick.
Yeah.
We go on 4-year cycles, if that.
With, like, say, for example, with scrummaging, like with the front row, would it be that players know how to, and again, I don't know the intricacies of what goes on there, but if a player comes out of a Super Rugby system and they get thrown into the Wallaby camp, that they already know what's expected, or do you learn different techniques or different ways of doing things between Super Rugby and Australia? Would the point of this centralisation, would that help in that regard?
I think it would help front rowers, but I think it would help the skill level across the board, because, you know, it's if Mitch and I both have a knife, how we use that knife is going to be different effectively. So, and it's the same, like, we want, there's things that are non-negotiable. So, like, the conditioning level is a non-negotiable. The skill level is a non-negotiable. But then what each individual Super Rugby team does with those skills, does with the skills they've learned, whether they're scrummaging or how they choose to use those skills, that's up to them. And that's where, you know, that's where the difference can be between the unions there as well, or those state unions as well, and how they can potentially, you know, look to have a little bit more success than other teams. But it's about bringing that bottom level up and just having what is an expected level of skill, and then bring it up starts with that talent ID program as well, like having children, having the kids have that certain level of skill and have an expectation that this is what is to be expected. And then that, once they start that during those pathways, it naturally will progress then up to a higher echelon, because, you know, I can still remember there's been times where guys that we have had over here in WA who ended up playing for the Wallabies and extremely high levels, like for national teams, you'd be running drills with them and, you know, you're running a switch and the coach would say, "And I run some switches here," and they'd run a switch and you'd get tackled by two blokes. And you say, "Well, what are we running this switch for?" And they go, "I don't know, because the coach said to run a switch." Hmm. And it's like, yeah, but, you know, what's been developed, like coming through the pathway, like there's none of the skill identification or the game nous that the players used to have in those 90s and the early 2000s that we always talk about. Like Eddie Jones talks about, it's that Australian brand of running, that rugby, that running rugby, that really smart rugby. Never been the biggest, fastest, strongest, any of that stuff, but we've just been smart and we've been willing, and we need to really bring that back. And I think having that level of centralization, having everyone working together to achieve that, we'll get some success.
Mm. So it's going to take someone brave to make it happen. Let's hope it does. Now we'll move on. We'll take a look at some of the club rugby that's going on around Australia at the moment. We had round 21 here in the West on the weekend. Cot 39 defeating UWA 15. So Cot keeping their season alive. Perth Bayswater and Wests was abandoned because of a golden staff scare amongst the Perth Bayswater camp. So that game, that round was cancelled. Wanneroo 33, Netherlands 22. So Netty is long gone. A real Associates 28, just getting up over Joondalup 27. And then Kalamunda and Palmyra, 5 minutes before half time, 19 all. At full time, 88-19. 79 unanswered points.
To who?
To Palmyra.
Oh, stop.
79 unanswered points by Palmyra in the space of 45 minutes.
Yeah, they turned it on, the Pally Kitties, didn't they? They just put the pedal to the metal and just carved them up in that back end of the half, and Keller had just no response. They were running on the spot for some of those tries. And good to see the old boy Chris Miller on the wing running amok out wide.
Yeah, hat-trick of tries.
And also Leighton Short, the return of Leighton Short in the last few weeks for Palmyra. He's going to play a big role in their, the contention for the premiership this year, I reckon. So Leighton Short, he's probably a really underrated player in my view. He's a quality player. He's well regarded in rugby circles in Perth Club Rugby. And again, he set up a myriad of tries on the weekend just through his hard running and be able to set up his outside backs. And there's nothing flash about that Pally forward play, Mickey, but they do the job. And they're very tradesmanlike in the way they go about it. And, a big turnaround from their upset loss the week before against Wes.
Yeah. It's Tyron Law, they're seven. He was very good on the weekend. And a bit of a shout-out to a winger, Simon Atafa, the number eight from Kalamunda. He played his 100th Premier Grade game on the weekend. So not the greatest result for him, but he's been a good stalwart out there at Kalamunda. So a good
spent
result
a bit of time
him.
In the NRC as well, winger.
Yeah. Did he?
Let's talk a little bit more about the other results, Mickey. That Soaks Joondalup game is a big turn up, that one. That if Soaks are bound to run away with a bonus point in that game, that could have really set them up for this weekend leading into this weekend's fixtures. And great to see Joondalup, who have had a bit of a mixed season, getting close to one of the top four teams in the competition as well. 28-27, that's a result I think Joondalup would be pretty happy with, given that they've had a bit of a mixed bag of a season.
Yeah,
and so certainly the Roodogs as well.
Because the latter at the moment, so Pally, they picked up the minor premiership. They got that cup on the weekend. So they're first on 72. UW on 64 in second place. They're fine. Wests are on 59. Associates 58. And Cottesloe 55. And Baysie 52. So only four of those teams can go through. I think Baysie are gone. So really it's between Cott and Associates and Wests for this the two out of those three. And this week's round's coming up. We've got Soaks are playing Southern Lions, so you'd think that'll be a win for Southern Lions. Yeah. And then you've got
UW's got the bye. West Scarves have got Wanneroo. Zero.
And Cottesloe got Palmyra.
Do you get zero for the bye?
Yeah, zero for the bye.
Yeah.
And Cotter got Pally.
Yep. So that Cot Pally game is going to be massive for Cot. I think the big one there, Mickey, is the West against Wanneroo. If they pick up the bonus point there, they could leapfrog Uni on the ladder, potentially.
Yeah.
Depends on the for and against and differential. But that also points back to that unfortunate draw on the weekend where Perth Bayswater and West shared the points,
Controversy around that as well.
There is a little bit of controversy around that. Let's talk about that. I mean, if West had received the forfeit points there, they would be equal point. They'd be 3 points better off than where they are
points,
now.
So they'd be on 62.
There'd be 2 points behind Uni.
Yeah.
Therefore, will we see that game in particular having an impact on the final four standings when we see how teams land come the end of Saturday night? So I think that Pally Cottesloe game is going to be huge on Saturday, but also Wes again, just those sleepers that just creep up on you.
Yeah,
they're like the boogeyman on a late at night coming out from under your bed, Mick. They just creep up on you.
Just to creep up, yeah.
Well, and that's the thing; they're doing it off the back of a big ugly pack of fours as well, just bloody lurking their way along, but just so effectively, aren't they?
Yeah, and I reckon the Palmyra's boogie team as well. Like, seriously, if there's a team that can... No, Wes.
Oh, Wes,
if there's a team
that
can knock Pally off for the premiership, it's Wes.
Yep. So, yeah, so an interesting final round coming up. And then over in the Shoot Shield match, Mitch, they're in semi-finals.
Oh, geez, semi-final.
Okay, we'll go up to Queensland first in the with the semi-final results. So in the major semi-final, Bond University played Wests, and it was Wests got up pretty convincingly in there. It was a closer game, but a high-scoring game. Wests got up 40-26 over Bond, which means they go straight through to the grand final in 2 weeks' time. And then in the other semi-final, the minor semi-final, it was Easts against Brothers, and Mitchy, the Brothers boys went down 46-29 to the boys from the Filth, which sets up a cracking game this weekend between Bond and Brothers. So Bond, they took out the minor premiership as well.
Yeah, they got the wobbles.
So they've got the second chance here, but this Brothers team's coming home red hot. Harry Wilson not picked in Australia A, so he's looking to make his mark for his boys from down at the Filth.
Yeah, go figure.
So it'll be.
We'll talk about Australia A in a moment.
Yeah, it's coming up.
Getting ahead of myself. Talk to me about Shoot Shield.
No, I watched that West Bond game too, Heath. It was like it was the all-star West team.
They finish every season pretty.
Oh my goodness! All-stars everywhere.
Well, not last year. This time last year, they had Jordan Uiseley. They had Carter Gordon playing for them as well. Jordan Pataia. So they missed a few. They've missed a few blokes this year. But Elvia Prinsloo's managed to fill a few holes effectively at the back end of the year.
And Reds and all sorts of the Western Force players floating around in the Brisbane teams as well. It's amazing. You know, Hamish Stewart having a bit of a cameo for Brothers over there. It's just a melting pot of professional players in the Brisbane comp at the moment, and they all could be stripped out come the Australia A game. So the quarterfinals for the Shoot Shield, Mickey. Two absolute cliffhangers on the Saturday. Northern Suburbs took on the Wildfires. Northern Suburbs hung on right at the death there. The Wildfires had their chance to win with some opportunities 5 metres out in the death, and they faffed it. Gone begging and heartbreaking for the Wildfires, going down to Northern Suburbs 23 points to 17. And the Ramwick-Gordon game, even though the final score was 32 points to 23, it was a try against the runner play in the dying minutes where Gordon were peppering the Ramwick line and the ball was turned over and they went the length of the field to really seal the win there. So those two games on Saturday could have gone either way and just goes to show how close the Shoot Shield was this year. But Eastwood ran away with it on Sunday, 54 points to 20 to end Manly's season. And the poor, luckless Marlins, they get a second bite of the cherry because of where they finished on the table, lucky for them. But their luck in finals hasn't been great over the last 10 years. I don't think they've won a final in some ridiculous amount of time. So that sets up the semi-finals this weekend for Ramwick v Eastwood, which will be an absolute cracker. And Northern Suburbs will take on Manly. And the winner of those two games will go through to the granny on the 26th.
So all happening in Sydney and Brisbane. And that'll take us to the mailbag. And the big news during the week, obviously, was the Wallaby squad. Now, I'll just very quickly go through it. So there's six props: Angus Bell, Pone Fa'amasuli, Zane Nongwell, Blake Shoup, James Slipper, and Taniela Tupou. Hookers: Matty Faisler, David Parecki, and Jordan Ulesi. Locks: Richie Arnold, Nick Frost, Matt Phillip, and Will Skelton. The back row: Lange Gleeson, Tom Hooper, Rob Leota, Fraser McWright, Rob Valentini. Three scrum halves: Isaac Fiennes, Lele Wasa, Tate McDermott, and Nick White. So two Western Force players in there, which is great. Fly halves: Carter Gordon, and well, really just that's Carter Gordon. Centres: Lalakai Fekete, Samu Karevi, Isaiah Parisi, and Jordan Pataia. Outside backs: Max Jorgensen, Andrew Kellaway, Marika Korobetti, Mark Nawanga Nitawaze, and Suliasu Avunuvalu, and the two utilities, Ben Donaldson and Josh Kemeny. So no Pete Samo, no Reese Hodge, no Quade Cooper, no Jed Holloway, no Tom Wright. Were you surprised, Mitch, that some of the ones that got in and some of the ones that didn't get in?
Yeah, look, certainly surprised at Josh Kemeny ahead of Pete Samu. I thought Pete Samu probably could have been our utility lock, given that he can play all three positions in the back row, but Josh Kemeny could probably cover lock at a pinch as well. But also, Matt Phillip was a bit of a surprise selection for me too, Mickey. Like, I know he's a bit of a grafter, but there's other players out there when you look at Darcy Swain and Cade Neville and the like that have missed out in the lock spots. You know, the value of having Matt Phillip there. is a little bit of an interesting one, especially getting ahead of Jed Holloway, who I didn't think had done too much wrong in these recent tests.
And that's it. Matt Phillips is just an out-and-out lock, whereas someone like Jed
can be multiple cover.
He plays all seasoned in the second row and then plays back row for the Wallabies. So.
But I'm really excited for young blokes like Blake Shoup, you know, the prop, who I think is going to be a real bolter. Like, I'm just keep your eye on him. I reckon he's going to be something of the future. Obviously, very youthful Angus Bell, Zane Noonga, there as well, making up that trio of young props. So Pony Famasuli and Taniela Tupou as the big units up front. Yeah, they sort of picked themselves. A bit surprised at Jordan Ulisse getting ahead of young Lonergan. I didn't think Ulisse probably had done enough in the earlier tests, what he's been to show off the bench. But, you know, like these are all sort of the positions that you could probably say were 50-50 calls, and Eddie had the call. Great to see Langie Gleeson get a go. He's sort of come from obscurity a little bit and has probably taken that position that Pete Saamu probably would have been eyeing off. But we all like Langie Gleeson. I think he's an outstanding rugby player and he's got loads of upside. And then the halves, Isaac Fiennes, what a bolter that was, getting ahead of young Lonergan as well. And the Brumbies, if they sit back and look at this team, they could probably go, well, what do we need to do to get more Wallabies in the World Cup squad, guys? We've been absolutely decimated. There's nothing, not much in there at all. But, it just goes to show where Eddie's mind's at as far as making sure he's got balance. Isaac's running game is really exciting, as we all know. So he brings that point of difference, and he might get a few starts in those pool games, especially against the Georges and the like, outside of the Wales Fiji game. So, yep. And Donaldson was the other prize selection for me, is that utility fly half, whether or not he'd done enough to justify a position to back up Carter Gordon. But I did note that James O'Connor was training with the squad up here in Darwin last week and looking pretty sharp, mind you. So you never know.
Because when's the last game Ben Donaldson's played?
Yeah, what has Ben Donaldson done? Full stop this year.
Holden pitch shields, hasn't he? Most of the season.
He does it well.
I would love to see James O'Connor in as that utility back. I just think if you're not going to take Quaid, then O'Connor with his spark, and I thought O'Connor's had a pretty handy Super Rugby season as well, and has had limited opportunities during the rugby championship in the test. But there's a whole heap of upside of that. The Max Jorgensen one was a real surprise selection. I'm a big fan of Corey Toole because he's a finisher.
Yep.
He's got genuine jet shoes. Yes. He can finish. He can score tries from anywhere. But then you need that coverage at fullback, which Max Jorgensen gives you. So you're a little bit light on in the fullback department at the moment with only Callaway
there. We're all Eddie's talked about is this smash and grab. It's all out for the World Cup, a smash and grab trip and everything going forward. Like, this is the year. But then he's gone and picked all of his chat around his squad is how good they're going to be in 2027. So Mitchie, can you answer that? How does that balance out that we're going for a smash and grab? So we're going to pick. How many of our squad?
He'll pick a core group.
A third of our squad hasn't got Wallabies experience.
Yeah. So he'll pick a core group. You watch come those really important test games in the World Cup. He'll pick a core group that can win the game. That's the smash and grab.
Even though they've never played together.
Yeah. And then he'll pick an extended group that he'll bring through. So I reckon
he's got it a bit wrong. And look, all this talk around this smash and grab, and then all of his talk as well around, we need the guys, we would pick those last three guys in the group or the extra guys that aren't going to play. Tell you what, having Quade Cooper over there, I've been a big critic of Quade Cooper, but having Quade Cooper over there, even if you're not going to play him, having him in that group is going to add a whole lot more than maybe Ben Donaldson is going to add. I don't think Carter Gordon's going to look over and go, what should I do, Ben? Yeah. I think Carter Gordon's going to look over at Quaid and say, mate, what do you know?
Let's have a chat. I don't disagree, but, you know, maybe.
And that's getting very specific.
You've just got to grow up, you know. You just got to move on and think for yourself now.
But speaking of that growing up, I reckon.
Quaid Zen didn't quite match the team dynamics with the rest of the team Zen. I don't know.
Because
he's got different frequencies, different crystals.
I read the All Blacks, their All Blacks number 10s have got a combined total of 200 caps Ours has got six.
Roll those dice, I say. Roll the dice.
And test the three hookers that we've picked. Matty Faisler, one test. Dave Parecki, 14. Jordan Ulessi, 18 tests. Are they the guys? Are they up for it? I mean, it's a big job.
In all honesty, I don't want to sound overly critical, but you can see what Eddie prizes above all else, and it's just that bulk, just that size. That's all he wants. He wants big guys, and he keeps trying to say that he keeps thinking I'll be able to work them into getting the finer tuned points right. But you know, with some guys, some of those players, you know, like Jordan Ulessi, he's had plenty of chance. Like how many caps has he played? He's been in squads 18. For 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, 18. 18.
And sure, he is one of the best scrummagers, big physical body to have on the field. But like, you know, you need to be able to hit your set piece, your line out. You need to be consistent around that. And if you can't be consistent, then you haven't got a spot on a, you know, on an international rugby field, as far as I'm concerned. So I thought, you know, maybe Lonergan. I think Lonergan's going to struggle getting game time underneath Eddie Jones just for his size. Like he's going to look at him and he's going to think he's not an international rugby player. But then I thought Falau Fanga was quite good when he finished off the season. So he's probably been a little bit hard done by. Both of those guys are in the Australia A squad. Matty Faisler, I think if he did as much experience as Jordan Ulessi had, he'd be just about starting. I think he's got a lot of potential physically. You can see he's there, and he came on and did a really great job in that last All Blacks game for the Wallabies in some trying situations. You know, he was thrown in. He wasn't even named in the 23, and then, you know, a little injury in the warm up or wherever it was before the match, and he ends up going on and then ends up playing. I think it was between 15 and 60 minutes of rugby over there in Dunedin and held himself really well. So I think he's got some really good potential, and he's solid around his set piece. So I think they've got it as close to right as can be. It's just it's just like we see Eddie's just he wants that bulk, he wants that size across everything. If it's going to come down to splitting hairs between two people, yeah, I think he's going to go with the bigger guy. But speaking of those bigger guys, I think Pone Famasili, he's one of the guys that could make a man out of Pone the next kind of few months. He's someone that's been there or thereabouts and in and out of his Melbourne team and always playing well. But now, you know, he's got a lot of a big opportunity and a lot of pressure on his shoulders. But like, he's going to be the guy with Taniela Tupou to go forward and take this team, especially this scrum through this World Cup. So I'm excited to see if he's going to be able to take this opportunity by both hands and really grasp it going forward as well.
How many games do you need to get? Because, look, I don't know, whatever the 15 we put out, I don't know what the combinations are going to be. There's not going to be any massive ones. So how long have these guys got enough time on their smash-and-grab mission to actually form some combinations to allow them to execute this smash-and-grab mission? How long is it going to take them?
Oh.
Well, you can't.
Have they got time in this World Cup or not?
Well, there's no set number of matches. Yeah. I think you've got to look at the combination. So you take McDermott, Carter Gordon combination, how, you know, you've got to look at how well are they combining as a pair at the moment with the limited time they've had together plus training. So you want to keep that pair together as much as you can, as often as you can at the moment. Yeah. And it's just, then it's about how you get your combinations together across the field. So your Sami Kereva, Jordan Patea combination, you know, they've played a fair bit of football together now through the Reds system and the Wallabies. So you just go, that's the system. That's the guys we're going with. And we've got to keep them together as often as possible, as best as possible all the time. And then you just build those little combinations throughout the team. So I don't think it's a thing, they've got to have 20 matches together or two matches together. I think it's just about having those little combinations that all fit together as part of the puzzle. That's the only way they're going to do it, and hope that it all clicks on the day.
And then before did you have something to
test? It's just a little bit of cross your fingers and hope for the best.
Yeah. And then before we move on, Eddie always talked about, you know, wanting these utility players that could pick various positions. Vunivalu is a rank of the right wing, and I think that's the only place he's played. Were you surprised that he made the cut?
I'd love to hear your opinion on this, Mick. What? It's okay.
I think he's extremely fortunate that he's in there.
Well, somebody has to carry the bags, Mick.
Yeah, but Eddie, he's a big body. He's a big athletic human being, and Eddie sees something in him. But I just think, geez, he hasn't.
Mickey, I'm sitting here waiting to be proven wrong. Prove me wrong. That's all I'm asking.
Yeah.
Tell me
I think he might, you know, maybe against Georgia and Portugal, I think he'll be a superstar because he's just athletic. And when he gets the ball in hand, he's good. But I just think his rugby knowledge isn't there from what I've seen. But, you know, what do I know about wingers? But anyway, hey, and look, we'll move on. So the Australia A team has been picked. They're playing Portugal on September 26th. There's August 26th, sorry. Yep. So Wright, Samu, Lonergan, they're all in the Australia A team. No Quade Cooper. So he's gone from the starting 15 to outside the top 55 in the space of 4 weeks. But Mitch, what do you notice about the timing of that?
What I notice about the timing, Mick, is that they've chosen to put the Australia A v Portugal game on August 26th, which just so happens to be the same weekend as the grand finals for Brisbane, Sydney and Canberra.
So
all this talk about supporting club rugby and connecting with club rugby has completely gone out the window. So we're going to take 26, we're going to rip 26 players out of the grand finals and final system in three of the heartland club systems in Australia and fly them to Paris for a one-off game against Portugal. So I don't know what that's going
to
cost.
That's a hell of a trip to get on. That's
a great trip. That's better than Bloemfontein.
I reckon there'd be. And you don't reckon there'd be a few guys there sniffing around for extended contracts with French clubs and how do I get an overlay for an extra few weeks in Rugby World Cup time? But then from that one game, Eddie might go, right, you 16 blokes and we'll bugger off home and we'll keep you 10 blokes here in France in case we get injuries. And we can, rather than fire you half all the way around the world to sub in, we've got you just down the road.
Where will they stay? They'll house them over there. So I wonder what they're going to. I wonder what they're dropping on this Australia A. Let's have some reserves hanging in France for a couple of weeks.
Oh yeah, but
What's the Portugal rugby union worth?
I'm going to say it now because I've got a vested interest. But Gungahl and Eagles down in Canberra, who won on the weekend against the Vikings,
They don't need Pete Samu.
True to the granny, they're going to lose Pete Samu and Corey Till for the granny. They'll probably still win. I will hope they do still win. But Tuggeran on Vikings, who got dipped out, who won the minor premiership, they've got a do-or-die match this weekend. They're going to lose Darcy Swain and the two Lonergan brothers, so they won't have them for their must-win match this weekend.
Yeah.
And that's just a small example, I suppose.
Who else? Sarah Eru, Brad Wilcombe is playing for East. Sarah Eru, he won't be available. Matt Gibbon won't be available for Bond. Reece Van Neck won't be available for Issa Dunn. Sorry, I've already said that. Yeah. Who else? Yeah.
I don't know who's
James
playing.
James O'Connor won't be playing. Hunter Paisami, they won't be playing.
He's out.
West Australia in the GF. They're in the grand final already.
He's out. Fluke, so all those blokes won't be playing.
All the centres have come from the and they're all teams that are still remaining in the comp.
Dylan Peach was playing for Ramwick on the weekend, so he'll be out.
He's gone.
Yeah, so he'll be out.
There's a few club boys who have played most of the season and have been pushed to the side for a Super Rugby player. They're fist pumping there.
They're back in. But you just go, oh, really? I just don't know if there's – like, I understand you've got to have some backups in France for the World Cup and it's, you know, there's a big concentration on the World Cup, but really, do you really throw that in the face of the club system that you're trying to win over at the same time?
Yeah.
And to spend a fair whack of money on the process too, Mickey.
Wouldn't be cheap. And because you'd think that, you know, the French club rugby could put together a team to play Portugal. I don't know why it had to be Australia A on that weekend.
Well, the other upside is, you know, the Wallabies will still be preparing off the back of their game against France. They'll still be preparing leading into the World Cup. So that gives them an extra number of bodies to have fully opposed training right up to the lead up to the World Cup as well. So there's a lot of upside, I suppose, around the whole theory. Yeah. But it's, if I was a couple of those clubs there that were banking on a couple of those professional players playing finals,
help you out.
You'd be scratched. Yeah.
It's still a bit of
Bit of depth, as you say, Heath, opportunities for others.
Correct. And a bit of World Cup news. So France fly half Romain Ntamack. He's been ruled out of the Rugby World Cup with a knee injury. So a lot of these players would be just having their fingers crossed every time they do any sort of opposed transitional game that they just
cotton wool.
They come through unscathed. And then a couple of signings. The Western Force, they've confirmed the signing of loosehead prop Harry Hoopert. He's committed to the Force until the end of 2025. And then some news that's no longer news, but I saw it earlier today. The headline was Western Force eyes NRL's most in-demand man. And it was Rugby Australia franchise Western Force reportedly entered the race for Payne Haas from the Broncos. And they were talking about, you know, $1.5 million a year. They need a top up from Rugby Australia. McLennan said that he'd spoke to his dad, but then it came out and it said that he's staying with the Broncos. So that's all
Thank
good.
Thank God for that, Mick.
That was a whirlwind 6 hours.
We haven't heard from Hamish for a little while. Where's he been?
Yeah, I don't know.
He's dropped off the radar. It's been the Eddie show of late.
It's because they're not winning. If they were winning, you'd be hearing from him. And then still in rugby league land, former NRL star Joel Kane, he's called on Rugby Australia to offer Queensland Maroons fullback Reece Walsh a mammoth deal worth $15 million over 5 years. So he must be a manager or something. He must have some sort of take on this is Joel Kane. He thinks that Rugby Australia should pay Reece Walsh, the Reds Queensland fullback, $15 million over 5 years.
Oh, of course, yeah, we can afford that, can't we? We just heard from Herbie saying we're in complete financial disarray. Sort of
competition.
Yeah, so just very, very strange. So, and then the Basie, we talked about Basie with their golden staff. The rumour is that they might actually be allowed to play this weekend. Some of the players seem to have recovered. A couple of them ended up in hospital, so it was a pretty nasty little thing going around Basie, but I believe they might be right to play, which is, I think, is Nettie's this weekend. Test their props. So
yes, it will be. So that's the only way Natties gets their points.
So that'll do us. Otherwise, it was great. I think great to talk to Herbie, and
that was a good call.
And obviously, a lot of interest around that, the Wallaby squad and the Australia A as well. So that'll do us. So mate, Mitch, good to talk to you again. Good to see you.
Good to see you, lads. We'll track all the rugby movements across this week, and we'll get together soon.
Yep, absolutely. And Tess, good to see you.
Yeah, it was good. Good. A few little weeks off.
Will I see you Saturday?
Yeah, fingers crossed.
We don't know where, do we, though?
We just don't know where.
Surely you're doing the Pally Cot game, surely.
Well, you'd think so, but I thought originally it was meant to be Basie.
It was meant to be Nettie's Basie.
And Nettie's. Oh, but God. You'd think the COT game, surely, because that's do or die for COT. So, and that'd be a good game. But look, out of our hands, Mitch. We are but humble servants of.
You just pointed in the right direction and WA. To your talents.
Yep, that's it.
Not even the right direction sometimes. No.
But good to see you both. Thanks for everyone for tuning in. We'll catch you next time on the Rugby Wrap.